Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday, the 13th of January, the first month. I'm already losing track. It's good morning. 13 minutes past 9 o'clock on the 13th day of the month. And we come in this morning listening to Ronnie Spector, a 60s icon who passed away yesterday at the age of 78. We'll be hearing the beautiful music of Ronnie Spector this morning, going in and out of our breaks. Well, in our breaks, I should say. Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome. It is great to have you here. Thank you for being with us, as always. Let me introduce the group to you, and we'll get started. A reminder, you can always be a part of our program by writing to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok is here, fresh from a taping of the Media Project. Good morning, sir. How are you?
And before that, a walk on the track and all like that, you know.
A busy morning. You've done more in the first, like, 3 hours of your day than most people have done in a week.
Absolutely true. I'm glad you recognize that.
Yes, absolutely. I'm also going to recognize the fact that two other guests were on the Media Project with you. So you've already had, like, basically, I think of that as a dress rehearsal. You two have already been going at it. So that's great.
Oh, them.
Yes, your good friends, otherwise known as them. Publisher Emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Joe, good morning. Good morning, everybody. And I'm so pleased that Sarah or Mike or whomever selects the music is playing Ronnie Spector music today. She was a big part of my youth. I was a formative young man in the early 60s growing up in New York City, and the Ronettes were the quintessential sound of that time. If you look at the Ronettes and, you know, Dion and the Belmonts and Little Anthony and the Imperials, that was the soundtrack of our teenage years. So a great sound, a great performer.
Well, you're absolutely right. Mike Bowen, our musical director today, or our musical editor, as a listener wrote, said, "Who is your musical editor?" And I said, "Well, on our staff of a couple of us, I don't know that we actually have one person for that, but today it's Mike Bowen." We also welcome Judy Patrick, who is also a guest on the Media Project, Vice President for Editorial Development of the New York Press Association, and with us this morning. Hello, Judy. How are you?
Hello, but a correction. I was not on the Media Project, so I am fresh. I'm ready to do battle with Dr. Chartok.
Okay.
Yeah, we needed you.
I thought you were on the show. I apologize.
I did not think you were there. And when when Joe just said, from the Media Project, I said, what?
No, that was
you probably thought
the wrong person. That's my fault. Yeah.
Maybe you thought I was very quiet.
Well,
you used to be a quiet person, but not so much anymore.
Yeah, right.
Retirement helps in that, I think. And then, last but certainly not least, we're always thrilled when she joins us. And we, even though she moved from Troy to Northampton, we still have her as a regular on our program. And it just makes my heart happy that she is with us. Fran Berman is a research professor and Stuart Rice Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences, and faculty associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Dr. Fran Berman, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning from balmy Northampton, where the palm trees are swaying and we're all putting on sunscreen.
Now you're a California gal. Have you ever gotten gotten used to this?
No, I have been in the Northeast, I don't know, 12 years now, maybe 13. You know, it's a whole new world.
Well, we're thrilled you're spending that whole new world with us, and I appreciate
it. I might be
it.
The only person in the Northeast who regularly uses the word dude, but that's okay.
Well, good morning, all. And again, you can be a part of our program by writing to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. So let's start with inflation issues. And so we've been talking about it on the show for a long time, and continued news coming out that basically saying what we already know, which is that inflation is high. Another key inflation measure hit a record high. This was announced just this morning as pandemic price hikes are not easing up for Americans. A Washington Post article today says that Democrats worry Biden could pay the political price for rising inflation. His advisors for months predicted inflation would be only transitory, a temporary problem that would fade as the economy rebounded and the supply chain issues were alleviated. But new data challenged the notion of just how long the high prices will last, exacerbating the problem inflation has become for the White House, with only 10 months before voters go to the polls. This for midterms, of course. Prices increased 7% over the 12-month period that ended in December, making 2021 the worst year for inflation since 1982. That according to the new report released by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The rise in prices for almost everything from gas and groceries to used cars and construction materials could intensify a political crisis for Biden and his Democratic Party. Inflation has a direct impact on the wallets of everyday people, and public opinion experts say risks clouding the way they feel about an economy that, by other measures, is stable and strengthening, which I think is a part of the conversation we have to take into account. Like, we look at the Dow, and it's, you know, it has bad days, but more good days than bad, right, Alan? So it's complex, but yet people are still going to the grocery store and spending perhaps, you know, on a weekly trip, maybe 20-30% more than they were a year ago.
You know, Joe, you've said it, and you've said it right as always. I mean, the stock market, it may be going up, but most people, when they buy that cabbage or that pound of chopped meat, knows what they paid and what they're paying now. And here's the inevitable truth. It is that if it happens on your watch, you're going to get blamed. That it may not be the fault of the president. It may be the fault of coming out of a pandemic. It may be any of that. But in the end, you got to have somebody to blame. It's political law number one. People want to blame somebody. You know, there are those of us who say, Trump set this whole thing up and made it happen. But in the end, this is very bad news for the president, the current president. And in fact, he'll get blamed for it because it happened on his watch. It's that simple.
And Judy Patrick, the other issue we have here, of course, is that nothing else really is going terrifically right for the president either, in the sense of Build Back Better, the dealing with COVID and now the Omicron variant, and voting rights. So there are there's this continual string of, maybe defeat is too strong of a word, but certainly not great successes, that add to this on top of the very real issue of what people are paying when they go to the gas station or they go to the grocery store.
It's true. His poll numbers are down and down a lot and have stayed down. He just can't seem to get much accomplished, even though his supporters will say, well, he did get things accomplished in the early part of his term. But, you know, if I had a nickel for every person who said they voted for Trump because their 401k did well, you know, I'd be able to buy myself a loaf of bread, I guess. But if you remember, during the Trump era, people were loving their 401k and they were using this as an excuse to support him. And I think it's ideology. People will gravitate to anything they can to support their position. Sure, gas prices are up, but you know what? Gas prices were up a lot, but have been up a lot before. People are still willing to fork over, you know, $10 for a pack of cigarettes. I mean, I think it's all relative, and I think it just helps you. It helps you justify where you're going in terms of your political leanings.
Fran Berman.
Yeah, I'm. I have to say, you know, to me, these are sort of not black and white issues, because
what I'd really like in the ideal my president to be doing is to be working at the long-term, medium-term, and short-term fixes for things. And I think we tend to focus on, you know, what's happening in the short term. So the need for infrastructure, which is real, and, you know, which Biden is trying to do, the need to sort of fix who gets to participate, that's the whole voting rights thing. And I have to say that these trends towards gerrymandering, towards voting rights that restrict the number of people who can vote, the success of these things really make me worry. I mean, all of those are things that we're going to be seeing more and more short-term consequences, but they're really sort of medium-term and long-term fixes. So what does this mean for Biden? You know, like many people, I've personally been kind of discouraged that he can't get more done and that he can't inspire us in some sense, in some of the ways that I felt at least inspired during the Obama and uninspired during the Trump administrations. But I don't know. You know, I'm frustrated by it. You know, here's a guy who's trying to do something with two hands tied behind his back, you know, which doesn't make it very easy. And it's also hard for us to, sorry, I'm rambling a little bit, but I think these things are really complicated. It's hard to sort of look at what's happening in the economy just by one metric. So yes, prices are higher, and that's something everybody feels. I feel that as well. But there are also more jobs. The stock market's doing pretty well for now. So the question, and then even when you look at sort of trade, that's starting to get righted because there's all these things that we have to look at in terms of our interactions with other countries around the world. So. It's a little frustrating to try to figure out, okay, you know, people will go to the polls and things will change. But, you know, all of those are short-term kind of things. And, you know, when are we going to pay attention to the medium and long-term things we need to create the ecosystem in which to thrive?
Ira Fussfeld, can you say anything to us that will inspire us and, most importantly, Fran?
Oh, they always call me Mr. Inspiration.
Yeah, inspire me, Ira. I would love that.
Listen, Alan is obviously correct. The president is going to take the credit or get the blame when the economy is good or bad, whether or not the president has anything directly to do with it. But I think the key issue for me, and I'm not suggesting that it's not predicting that it's going to happen, but the story that we're referencing this morning from the Washington Post asks if Democrats worry that Biden could pay the political price. Well, I don't think there's any question he's going to pay a political price. What might make this the midterms and the next election, the presidential election cycle, different in terms of the historic blame or credit that I just alluded to is the nature of the opposition. And again, I'm not predicting that this is the case, but are people who are ordinarily would go to the other side because they're fed up with inflation and they're going to blame the president, are they willing to do that in the face of what the other side blatantly represents this time, which is the death of democracy and the birth of autocracy? I certainly hope that will be recognized when people go to the ballot box, and that if in fact that's the case, this will be the outlier in terms of whether a president deservedly should be credited or blamed with the state of the economy.
Even if he's
how's that for inspiration?
Yeah, I don't know how inspirational it was, but it was a good answer. I'm interested in the idea of, you know, short-term and long-term, Alan, so obviously we referenced when I was reading from the Post, the 10 months between now and the midterms. Okay, got it. But we also have the much longer game, which is 2024 and what the president can do in that period of time. So I'm interested in that, and I'm also interested in what ultimately we make out of the fact that there are so many other factors into it that people may or may not gravitate to. I think I lost Alan. that I
no,
would.
Is that better?
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'm glad I was able to figure out the electronics of this.
I thought I inspired Alan to leave.
Of the situation.
So
no, I agree with much of what you said, but you got to remember who Joe Biden is. You might call him come from behind Joe. He didn't look like he was going to win the nomination. He won the nomination. He pulled it out at the last moment. South Carolina helped a great deal. So I'm not counting him out by any means yet. And I think he's going to get a lot of credit by the time it's all over for what he did in the first couple of years. And now he's just got to watch his behind because things are not going particularly well. And you can see the White House trying to respond as best they can to each of these crises, if you want to put it that way. It's not fun to be president of the United States in a time like this.
No, and I mean, how much, Judy, do you think that plays into it? Of, you know, I think anyone who thought that who was going to inherit what had happened in the previous 4 years knew it was going to be tough. So, and now I don't know that voters necessarily think that way, but a lot of people thought, well, this is going to be a very, very difficult ship to right.
Yeah, but I think that everyone wasn't banking on Omicron. I think if that hadn't happened, things would have improved much more quickly. And, you know, I'm still optimistic that things will turn around by the summer. I think people talking about the breaks in the supply chain, they say that, you know, that those things are going to ease up. And if Omicron eases, that will help with inflation. I think inflation is in part a reflection of the fact that there's strong demand and there's low supply. Fix the supply problem and you will ease it a little bit. But I never thought being president would be fun. I think Alan said that he thought Biden was hoping it would be fun. I don't think it's ever a fun job.
No.
I don't know why anybody wants it.
I got to hold you there, but we'll come back and we'll continue with our great group. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, and return right after news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning. Alan Chartok, Ira Fussfeld, Judy Patrick, and Fran Berman. I think right before the break, what we determined is that there's nothing fun about being president. Is that what we decided, right? I think that was
Yeah, but I think I may have been wronged by Judy. It doesn't happen often. When she said that I thought Biden thought it was going to be fun. I don't remember saying that.
Yeah,
I think
this is from the Journal of Duh.
yeah, this is a hard job.
You know, Joe, I wanted to follow up on something that that I think maybe you were saying. I forget who was saying it before the break, which is, you know, some of the short-term things that that Biden has done. Because I, you know, my hope is that these guys, the guys being a generic term in, you know, Congress and president and, you know, everyone in the government is thinking about the medium term and the long term, but they have to do short term things too. And I've got to say that during the time that Biden's been president, he has done useful short term things. You know, he's trying to get more tests to people now. He's trying to get more masks to people now. He has a task force where he's trying to help the supply chain issues with, you know, getting more truckers on the road and those kinds of things in the early part of the presidency, which was like only a year ago. You know, he got more vaccine to people when there were vaccine problems. So, you know, there are short-term things he's trying to apply. You know, I think Judy's right. You know, this whole Omicron thing has really thrown everybody for a loop. You know, we're already depressed about being into a pandemic for years. And the problems it's causing to our families, to the economy, to our lives, et cetera. And then, you know, here comes Omicron right around the holidays, which is, you know, the first time that, you know, people had hoped to see their families and, you know, celebrate in some, quote, normal, unquote, way. And so, you know, even though the Omicron news, you know, as something that might kill you is generally good, you know, it's less likely to kill you. It's still, you know, we're still in a pandemic. So, you know, I do think that that's kind of mucking up everything and makes it even harder for the Biden administration, which is not great at inspiring us, even though they're doing good things, you know, to, you know, get some positive press and maybe have that go into the next election.
Judy?
Yeah, and the good news that I'm reading this morning is that it seems like Omicron is cresting, at least in the Northeast. So, I mean, everybody's got their fingers crossed, and it's too early to say this for sure. But, you know, one of the interesting things they measure is the amount of Omicron in the wastewater in Boston and in sewage, essentially. And it's down 40% since its peak in December. So, woohoo, things are getting better.
I wouldn't want to be that tester.
Yeah, can I?
And what's around the bend?
Jumping in again.
Not at all.
If you don't mind me jumping in again, there's so many things to measure when you model this. And, you know, you can model emergency room visits and tests and hospitalizations and wastewater and the number of teachers that test positive and, you know, the rate of people that are unvaccinated and, you know, all of these kinds of things. And that's one of the things that makes it really hard, besides the fact that it's hard to get the data itself. It's one of the things that makes it really hard to model Omicron. But I'm like Judy. I love the fact that they're monitoring the wastewater, which is, in some sense, a more comprehensive indicator. And Judy is absolutely right. I've read similar things, that the wastewater numbers are going down. And that, you know, that gives me some hope.
So how come he's in the low 30s?
Boy, I tell you, I don't think anybody's going to the voting booth in next November or in 2 years after that, and is going to use that as a measurement for which lever they pull down. I mean, I'm hoping.
You don't think wastewater numbers are going to inspire people?
Not sure how you poll on that.
I think you get your finger on the pulse there, Ira. Go ahead.
But
somewhere.
The fact is that Biden has a number of accomplishments. Some of them more important than others, but as we've discussed here and elsewhere, they've not done a good job selling what they've done. The Biden we saw in his speech the other day is the first time we've really seen Biden try to, I'm going to be angry and start pounding on the lectern tact, and we'll see if that wakes up people. But the fact of the matter is that so much of this country gets their news from places other than the mainstream press, and thus are not necessarily even hearing about what accomplishments Biden has accomplished. So how are they going to vote against the opposition when they don't know what Biden did that was good? It's just very complex, and it's the frustrating would be the first word that comes to mind.
So let's go to some of the letters that we've been getting. Bill writes, inflation would be stopped dead in its tracks if we simply cut back on non-essential purchases until the supply chain issues are resolved. Prices are governed mostly by supply and demand. We need to cut back on demand in order to bring it into balance with currently available supplies.
Can you do that how?
Yeah, right. How easier said than done, right? I mean, if you need chicken, you need chicken.
Yeah.
or some non-meat substitute. I don't know.
Here's a bumper sticker.
Let's see. Sean writes, Ira has it right. As an independent, I see nothing being offered by the Republicans to fix anything, not to mention divided party governing will not fix anything in today's political environment. Let's see. We go to Robert, who says, we keep talking about how the Republicans have outmaneuvered the Democrats, but there are many local battles in every state, i.e. Ohio, where their Supreme Court has struck down Republican gerrymandered districts as illegal, giving the GOP 10 days to, quote, fix the maps and resubmit them. Nothing happens if we do nothing. And that from Robert. And that's the long game, right, Alan? I mean, that's when you're talking about the maps and the...
I'm glad he brought it up. And the fact is that whether they're Republicans or Democrats, as in New York State, they're going to do what's helpful to them in the long and short run, and they will. It's not pleasant. It's not right. It is what you expect. It's one of the reasons I think there maybe should be a term limitation. On legislatures, because when they misbehave this way and they only feather their own nests, it has a certain smell to it that is not very nice.
David writes to us and says, inflation has its roots in corporations raising prices using various excuses. They scream supply chain when the supply chain issues are mostly resolved. No reason to let a good crisis go to waste. And of course, there's always deficit spending by the evil Democrats. It never bothered corporate CEOs during the Trump era. Well, I don't know that I understand the point of the letter, but I don't know that the supply chain issues have been mostly resolved, right, Judy? I mean, it's still a lot out there that has to be rectified.
Well, Pete Buttigieg was out there, the Secretary of Transportation was out there yesterday saying that a lot of it has been addressed, but yeah, it's still a problem, and I think corporate America will look for any excuse to raise the price. They're going to raise the prices if they feel they can get more for their pack of chicken. They're going to charge more. I mean, they'll do what the market will take, and that's just capitalism. I think as we all know, when we go into our grocery stores, if you're looking, sometimes you can't find cat food. Sometimes you can't find paper towels. There are certain things that just aren't there. In fact, I've thought that we're such consumers in America. We expect to be able to find hazelnuts when we want them, or the mighty fine lemon pudding mix when I want it. Yeah, and we can't, and we say, oh, something's terribly wrong. Well, you know what? We've been kind of spoiled here in America. We just buy a lot of stuff, and we expect everything to be full all the time. And maybe a new reality would be for us to be less demanding of our stores.
Yeah. It is weird, though.
But the supply chain issue is real. It is not as bad as it once was, but it's compounded by bad weather, which we get every year. It's compounded by, I don't remember if it was Buttigieg or someone else who said 300,000 truck drivers are no longer available because either illness or they've quit. I saw an interview this morning of a manager of a grocery store with which I'm very familiar in Connecticut, and she was saying, you know, a hidden way the supply chain problem has arisen is that they were late on their delivery of blueberries, and when they finally got the blueberries were bad, so they sent them back. And now the store doesn't have any blueberries. So the point is, it's complicated, and it is certainly a contributing factor, even though it's better than it was some months ago.
Yeah, but Judy has a really great point. You know, we're capitalists in this country, so it is completely appropriate, although not always great, for businesses to try to make as big of a profit as possible. And if they can charge more, that's great. And we are used to getting what we want. And so, you know, if we can't get hazelnuts or lemon pudding, I want to come to your house for dinner, Judy. I'm just saying. you know, at the store,
lemon meringue pie here. Just so you'll know.
Okay, but I do like hazelnut, just saying.
You do?
If we can't get that stuff, you know, and we feel like, you know, the fabric of living is sort of falling apart. But, you know, there's lots of places where people sort of make do with what they have.
Yeah.
And that's just not our mindset. And so these things become more egregious to us. So, you know, I think Judy has a really good point. It's not just the economy. It's, you know, the way of life. It's our philosophy in which, you know, we create the U.S. economy. All of those things are sort of playing together to exacerbate these problems.
And let's not forget that the increase in the minimum wage, which was, don't get me wrong, very much overdue and it's earned. Nevertheless, that is going to be passed along to consumers. The companies that are now paying more for payroll are raising their prices.
Right.
So it's complicated.
Well, writes to us and says, you talk about how Biden needs to get good press, but you are the press, so maybe you could work a little harder to list all the things that he's done so far, such as rejoin the Paris Accord, the landmark infrastructure bill, executive orders that have put us back on track in dealing with climate change, job growth, the list goes on. Please say some of them, less hand-wringing, more facts.
To which I would respond. How did you find out? How did you find out about that?
It's all being reported except in the right-wing media.
Well, let's take a break when we come back.
And I would argue that it's kind of, that's old news. What has he done for me lately? And lately he has been less than inspirational. He needs to, he's supposed to be the great master of Senate compromise and working the Senate. He seems to have gotten nowhere with, especially with Manchin and Sinema. Let's see him work some magic that he promised he had. He said he was going to, you know, kill this virus with the vaccine, and that didn't happen. And there are all good reasons why it didn't happen, but, I mean, I think the press is within its rights to report this.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll add more letters, and we'll move on to other topics as well. Alan Chartok, Ira Fussfeld, Judy Patrick, and Fran Berman all with us this morning, and you can be as well. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Playing the music of Ronnie Spector this morning. She passed away yesterday. And we have a playlist online if you want to hear what we're playing at any given time today or any day. Just go to the website, wamc.org/roundtable, and you'll see the playlist. And you can see what we've got going on. Tim writes to us and says, Judy Patrick nailed it. American consumers are spoiled, spoiled, spoiled rotten. Bingo. That's what Tim has to say about that. We go to this letter from Jeff. The Republicans offer complete denial of global warming and embrace racism. They offer the hope that nothing has to change the ignorant. Until people are better educated and we find a way to clamp down on Fox News and the like, our problems will get worse.
How do you clamp down on Fox News? Maybe Judy could answer that one.
Well, and it's not just Fox News. It's OAN, and it's Facebook, and it's your neighbor with the wacky conspiracy theories. It's rampant. And you know what? I know how to solve it. Read your local newspaper. You know, I'm a newspaper advocate. But you know, and I also believe in increasing civic education, but not just for kids, but for grown-ups. I mean, there are so many people that don't even know the three branches of government. Probably the former president doesn't know those either. But I mean, education is important, and I think embracing people, engaging with them, talking about it. Don't be afraid to, you know, to tell someone who doesn't believe in vaccines to have a conversation with them. I mean, Rosemary has talked about this, Rosemary Armeo, but it's education. But can you clamp down on Fox News? No, you can't. But all you can do is remember that there are other sources of information. And as we've noted on the Media Project before, you know, the broadcast networks, CBS, ABC, NBC, their nightly viewership is higher than Tucker Carlson. So there are still a lot of people getting fairly normal information from broadcast.
Got this letter from William and want to pass it on to our Media Project types and, of course, Fran as well. But the panel seems oblivious, he writes, to the substantial failures, Afghanistan, the border, just to name two, that have pulled down Biden's approval rating. According to the latest Quinnipiac poll, Biden's job approval rating has dropped to 33%. He refuses to take questions, turning his back on reporters as they shout their questions, just the opposite of Donald Trump. Alan?
Donald Trump would take...
Donald Trump may have taken a question, but he didn't answer it, that's for sure. You know, it's just obviously a letter from somebody who has certain proclivities towards Trump to create that reality. It ain't so.
Judy?
Alan, you're exactly right. Alan, Trump would take a lot of questions, but he would just use the question as an opportunity to say whatever he wanted. You could see it in his interview with NPR this week, where he abruptly cut the call off after he was asked one too many questions he didn't want to answer. He doesn't like to be controlled. He uses the question as a window to just spout whatever he wanted to spout.
Remember those briefings, the coronavirus briefings at 5 o'clock at the beginning of the pandemic, where he was taking questions? I mean, I'm still traumatized by those. Those were a lot of questions were being asked, but there weren't any answers coming out. We go to Terry, who says, just stop it. Stop criticizing Biden because he doesn't have as much influence in Congress with these bunch of power-hungry obstructionists, Democrat and Republican alike, as he thought he would. He's doing the best he can, and I don't think he's doing a bad job. Instead of pointing out everything he can't get done, which is just playing into the Republicans' hands, how about talking about the things he has accomplished? I'm sick of the media complaining and complaining and complaining. Ira, how do you answer that letter?
Oh, you don't have enough time. Biden is not answering as many questions from the press. He's not having formal press conferences to any degree as did his predecessors. I think that's because they're afraid of leaving Biden largely unchecked. He's been known to misspeak, and so they would be embarrassing for him. On the other hand, he does have more of the scrums that are less formal, and he's apparently having those more frequently than his predecessors. But, you know, I keep going back to the same thing. Alan mentioned it before. These stories that people say we're not covering, where are they learning about them? They're being reported. The press is doing its job. And the bigger problem for the public, in my view, and for the press, is the silo effect, and that there are people who are choosing where they want to go based not on what is good or bad coverage, but on what they agree with or what they disagree with. And
Ira, I have a follow-up question, Ira, if I may, because I agree with much of what you say. What's a scrum?
Well, a scrum is basically when he's walking along and 4 or 5 or 10 reporters gather around him and ask questions. And then he moves on to the helicopter.
If he's on his way to the helicopter, or he's going from one room to another, and they'll have that group.
And the White House is arguing that he is doing that more frequently than his predecessors, thus he is not walling himself off. But there is something to say for the occasional formal press conference where you can ask questions and get a more detailed answer. And he's clearly not having as many of them as did his predecessors. I mean, Trump loved that. Trump, this was his wheelhouse. Yep. This is what helped get him popular in the case of many people, because he would tell Jim Acosta of CNN to shut up. And people who were tending to agree with Trump and didn't like the press were thrilled that he was talking back. So Trump would have press conferences at, you know, what time of day is it? Oh, yeah, I'll have a press conference.
Right. Fran?
You know, I mean, I just wanted to, I sort of agree with the letter writer. And, you know, and I actually thought that Biden brought back the regular White House press conference that, you know, Trump had, you know, been missing in action for a lot of the time and then used other kinds of venues and was very effective.
He did bring back, I mean, in fairness, he did bring back the daily briefing by the end of the administration of the last president. That had sort of gone away.
The thing that makes me so sad, really, is that marketing really, really, really matters to the American people. You know, as Ira's saying and everybody's saying, you know, that's how, I mean, we get our information from somewhere. And, you know, it's no longer just the, you know, one of the three big TV, you know, channels you watch. And, you know, it's cable, it's the internet, it's, you know, it's tweets, it's Facebook, it's, you know, so now there's a lot of information out there, a great deal of it misinformation. But, you know, that's sort of the job of somebody who wants to build community around the things they want to do, is to figure out how to harvest that and move forward. And I have to say, you know, Trump was really excellent at that, and something that I find continuously, you know, I think for ill to this country, but I think something I find really, really discouraging is, you know, how the other side, you know, Democrats and whomever, you know, cannot marshal these good news. You know, I wrote to all of you this morning when we got the information about how to call in, about, like, I was looking for some good news, and the only good news I could find is, you know, Barbie is going to release an Ida B. Wells Barbie doll on Monday, you know, on Martin Luther King Day. You know, it's like, is that really the only good news that we have? Tell me, you know, tell me that.
Well, and Maya Angelou on the quarter. That's the other good news.
Yeah, it's like, okay, can we have a little more good news than that? So I do think that what you hear and how you hear it really, really, really matters. And I think we have a sustained, ineffectiveness on the part of the Democrats in getting these messages out. And I think they make a big difference in elections.
Let's see. We have time for one or two more letters before we go over to news and Ray Graff. Kevin writes to us and says, we are entering into a period that can best be described as a perfect storm. Unrealistic expectations coupled with a large segment of society that has not known a prolonged period of want and disruption. Until there is an awakening within this country of what is doable and what needs to be done as a society to achieve that, we are headed into a dark time indeed. That from Kevin. There you go for inspiration. John's...
Well, can I give you one more piece?
Yes.
There is a lot more good news being reported than we're getting credit for. Depending on what your source is, there are all sorts of feature stories and gee whiz stories. I can recall many years ago people were complaining my newspaper didn't have enough good news. I literally took a ruler to the paper and measured it out to show that we had more good news in the paper than bad news. It's in the eye of the beholder.
Anyone else on that, Judy?
No, and in terms of reporting what the administration is doing, the Biden administration does, they do take pains to advance what they're doing and to give a platform to the administration officials announcing, you know, that they're sending more troops to the states to help them deal with the virus. You know, that's today's good news. Then they are reporting it. And now the press's job is to see how it goes, to see if it's effective. And maybe it won't be effective, and then that will be bad news.
You know, not to burst your bubble, Fran, and we have to go to a break, but a listener just wrote and said, and I guess this is true because they sent the citation, the Ida B. Wells Barbie doll is already sold out because of supply chain issues. So, you know, you try, and look what happens.
I love that listener.
All right. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with our group, Alan Chartok, Ira Fussfeld. Sorry, Ira. Judy Patrick and Fran Berman will be back right after this. Ronnie Spector with Eddie Money, who left us, I believe, in 2019. So remembering Ronnie Spector this morning, we have all the information on our playlist is on our website, wamc.org/roundtable. Okay, let's go to a couple more letters, and then we'll move on to other topics if that works for everybody. James writes, in my mind, Biden has done a lot of good things and some not so good things. He's still 10,000 times a better president and better human being than Trump ever could be. John said,
Joe, that is so true. And one wonders if that doesn't reflect into some degree the national character of contemporary America.
Right.
I mean, the fact,
because that used to matter, right? Who is the better person?
Yeah. Very, 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 a very scary proposition that somebody like Trump, who is really a scoundrel, could be taken as seriously as he is by those people who want to maintain the power that they've acquired over the years and who don't give a damn about the American character. It's really very sad.
John writes, if you were wondering why our politicians are not working for us, why they have their heads stuck in the sand, how would you behave if you had death threats against you and your family? It's a new game, life and death. The politicians are scared to death, and Donald Trump is the puppet master. Jason writes, companies always say how higher wages will increase prices, and that's true. But they never give the math. If McDonald's, for instance, raises wages to $15 an hour, how much per burger over a day does that add? My guess would be a few cents. It's a red herring in many cases. Go ahead. Yes, Fran.
Yeah, Joe, I mean, I have a question for everyone, and this is an incredibly naive question, but, you know, Trump still is the puppet master. He's not president anymore. And my own reading of the numbers is that his base is not big. And so why is he such a powerful influence on the Republican Party? Why hasn't there been a really effective counter focus for the Republicans? I'm a bit, and I apologize for being naive, and maybe you'll kick me off the program now, but
really?
I'm a bit mystified by that still.
They're holding on to power for dear life. These are the haves in our society, Fran, and they don't want to give it up. And so as a price for not giving it up, they'll unite under a leader who consistently in his reminds me of Hitler. I'm sorry, there will be those people who write me more letters saying you should never compare him to Hitler. But he has adopted the Hitler playbook in terms of harnessing public appeal and everything else. And the brown shirts who are behind Hitler, I hate to say it, they're right there in the Republican Party. May I just say, not all Republicans by any means, because there are good Republicans. I think the Bushes, for example, and the Cheneys and the other guys are now being hailed as heroes because they won't put up with, this potentially fascist president.
Two letters, and then we'll change the subject here. John,
and Joe, if I could jump in on that last letter about the minimum wage and not impacting prices.
Yes.
I mean, you can ask Aaron if he's on tomorrow. He's the economist.
He is not.
Maybe my point here is going to be wrong, but I can only tell you from personal experience of running a company for 25 years was that when we had increased expenses, whether they be salaries or the price of goods and services, that inevitably meant we were going to raise our prices somewhere else, either the cost of our advertising or circulation. So in my experience, there very much is a correlation between increasing salaries and how much you pay for the product that you're providing.
John writes to us and says, the bottom line is that no one in America is starving to death because of supply chain problems. Americans should count their blessings. Scott says, for those blaming Biden for rising prices in goods and services, are they really asking big government to interfere with market forces now? Doesn't that sound a lot like the dreaded socialism conservatives have been warning us about? All right, let's go to some other issues here as we make our way through this Thursday morning. I wanted to talk about, let's go to Kevin McCarthy and January 6th. So I think when I initially sent out a possible topic for today, the headline was the January 6th committee is hopeful that Kevin McCarthy will cooperate. Then, in a blink of an eye, that headline changed to Kevin McCarthy refuses an interview request from the January 6th committee. The House Select Committee scrutinizing the January 6th attack on the Capitol on Wednesday formally requested an interview with Representative Kevin McCarthy, taking the unusual step of calling the minority leader who was in close contact with former President Trump before, during, and after the violence and has fought to shut down any investigation of the events. Mr. McCarthy quickly announced that he would refuse to cooperate, but the request sent a clear message that the committee's investigators are willing to pursue the highest-ranking figures on Capitol Hill for information about Mr. Trump's mindset as the violence unfolded. A federal judge has suggested the former president's attitude will be pivotal to determining whether Mr. Trump can face any liability for the mayhem of that day. You'll remember that Kevin McCarthy was one of the people we learned very early on was coming out and saying, this is on January 6th, saying that the president had to do something. He went on the floor of the Capitol a few days later and said, condemning it, and said that Mr. Trump bears responsibility for the violence. Mr. McCarthy said on the floor of the House, what we saw last week was not the American way. Neither is the continued rhetoric that Joe Biden is not the legitimate president. That lasted about a week. And then Mr. McCarthy eventually changed his stance, re-embracing Mr. Trump and visiting him at his Mar-a-Lago club in Palm Beach, Florida, just a few days later. This sort of gets back to what we were talking about earlier, Alan, of holding on to that power, right?
Well, I think it does. The other part of this is that if you think Kevin McCarthy wants to go and testify under oath about what went on between him and Trump, think again. Clearly, it's way too dangerous. In fact, it is a lie. If you lie to Congress, you set yourself up for a jail term. I think that's one way of looking at it. The other is that he's obviously on the phone with the ex-president or knows what the ex-president wants at very least, and he's not going to violate that because he knows that the ex-president has a stranglehold on the Republican Party. And by the way, he wants to be speaker
right.
If he wins.
He wants to be Speaker of the House.
Yep.
Right. And we know, I mean, they've opened up the playbook. We know what their game plan is. People like McCarthy and Jim Jordan and Perry, another representative, are not going to cooperate unless they have to. And I'm not sure, this is a sort of a sidebar question as to whether or not they can ever be compelled to testify other than through a subpoena. But we know that they are stretching this whole plan out through as long as they can for this year, and then hopefully for them, they will get control and the investigations are going to go away. And in the meantime, they're going to stall. The question I don't know the answer to is something like McCarthy refusing to testify or cooperate, is this something that can reach the Supreme Court or not because it's an internal congressional matter?
Mm. Anyone
good
know?
Question. Yeah. And a good question, and it does. I think these are uncharted waters, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
But assuming it reaches the Supreme Court, are you kidding?
What's this court going to do?
It's a jump
right.
ball at the best.
Yeah. Right, at best. Judy, your thoughts on this?
This news came on the same day that we learned that Kayleigh McEnany, the former White House press secretary, did voluntarily go and talk to the committee. I mean, she's made a name for herself on Fox News. She continues to do so. You know, you should know that the committee has phone logs. They got some records from phone companies that they know. They don't know the content of the calls, but they know these calls were going back and forth. So they have some indication that something happened, and they want to know what McCarthy and said to Trump and what Trump said back to McCarthy, and he doesn't want to say this. It really questions our ability to have a government of checks and balances. The Congress should be able to check the executive branch, and it should go back the other way as well, I concede, but their refusal to cooperate under the guise that this is just a partisan political exercise, it really strikes at the heart of what we're trying to do as a democracy, and that is to keep the different branches of government in check.
I think they must feel meaning the Trump people, must feel that Kayleigh McEnany had nothing to offer that would hurt them, or else they would have blocked her from showing up also. It seems to me that she left that position before the inauguration,
yes.
And she may not have even been on board that on January 6th.
Well, it was the final days, but I think it was after January 6th. that she left.
No, but she, the committee has noted that she was with Trump at times during the attack on January 6th.
I hadn't heard that.
So, yeah, what was going on? Fran Berman.
Well, I have to say I'm really bummed but not surprised about that. You know, and again, that's the calculus. Like, what did Trump say, you know, given what McCarthy said, you know, after the attack? You know, what did Trump say that made the calculus for him to not want to talk to the committee, you know, make sense? And, you know, why is he so... why is that so powerful? And you know, I really appreciate what everybody else is saying, and I appreciate you answering my somewhat naive questions, but it really is quite mystifying to me how he holds on to power. The other thing I wanted to say to you is we often talk about surveillance in this society, or at least in my world, we talk about it a lot, and we talk about it regularly on the roundtable. And you know, there are positives and negatives to surveillance. So now, you know, there's very little kind of communication you can do in the digital world, which is most of the communication has some footprint in it that people can't find out about. And, you know, sometimes that's a good thing. You can figure out all the things that might have been in a different era previously more secret. And sometimes that's a bad thing because it can be used for ill, it can be biased, it can be not fair, it can be an overreach. You know, there's all kinds of issues about that. But, you know, to me, the fact that we don't even think it's noteworthy that we're now in this kind of technological ecosystem in which you can find out these things is interesting. And it really means that, you know, the world is changing around us. And you know, part of my work, you know, apart from the roundtable, is to, you know, as a public interest technologist, is to make sure those technologies are largely used for good.
So why isn't it more noteworthy, and what do we do to make it more noteworthy?
Well, you know, I mean, it's not so noteworthy because, you know, my guess is that almost all of us use technology, you know, many, many times every day. You know, like a lot of other people, I have family text going. I communicate by email. I communicate in ways that are captured somewhere in the digital world. And can also be replayed, repeated, found out about. And I just think we're all used to that because those are the tools of our time. You know, it's not carrier pigeons or people on horses carrying messages, or, you know, it's the internet. So I don't think it's surprising that we're in this world. I think this world is increasingly a Wild West, and we need some sort of laws to protect us from ways in which technology exploits us. And the tricky thing is that's always a double-edged sword. The things we really enjoy about technology are also the things that can be used in exploitative fashion. And so the way we deal with things, you know, like having a factory is a good thing, but if that factory pollutes, it's a bad thing. And so, you know, the way we usually deal with that in society throughout the decades and the millennia is to, you know, provide some sort of public sector oversight that makes sure we point things in the right direction and penalize things that really go in the wrong direction. And that's the time we're in with technology right now. We need to create more policy, laws, standards, you know, oversight for the technologies that can exploit us, that can make things less private, that can make things less secure, that can, mess things up in various ways. And we need to do that. But of course, as we've all been talking about for these 2 hours and really whenever the roundtable is on, you know, Congress is focused on winning. You know, whichever side you're on, they're focused on winning. They're not focused on the public interest. They're not focused on long-term infrastructure, and that includes cyber infrastructure, you know, for the most part. You know, they're focused on the next election and getting the most people and undoing what the last guys did. And, you know, as your resident old hippie, you know, I'm really discouraged by that.
Are you sure? Are you sure? I mean,
about which part of that, Alan?
Yeah, no, I'll tell you.
You're definitely a resident hippie, but go ahead.
No. Are you sure that when, let's say, a Republican, a Jim Jordan, or the other guy, says what they're saying, that they're saying it out of the need to win electoral victory as opposed to doing what's right for the American democracy? In other words, if you were inside their brain, and had the ability to see whether what their utterances were based on, the question I would have is, are you sure that it's pure, you know, political rhetoric as opposed to what they really think is American, which would be far more dangerous in my mind?
Well, the obvious answer, and you are quite right, is I am not inside their brains, and I don't know. So I'm just sort of taking.
Well, take a stab at it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, my imagination is that if you're in Congress, the thing you're worried about is staying in Congress, and staying in Congress has a lot to do with your party and how much they support you. I mean, you guys are way more savvy about this than me, but I think it's impossible to stay in Congress if your party does not support you. And I think that in order for your party to support you, these parties are worried about winning. And they're worried about, you know, having the majority. And so, I mean, that's my imagination about how it really happens. And I don't know, you know, debug me if I'm wrong.
Well, I would suggest that calculus could change if the Republicans win the Congress in November and then Trump or someone like Trump wins the general in 24, because they'll address tech issues. They'll address them any way they want and clamp down. All we have to do is see what their complaints about tech has been before. The fact that the public will have the opportunity to see what they do and then vote them out of office, well, that may not happen either, because they're going to change the election laws to make it more difficult. I go on and on. I just think that the potential for I'll use the word disaster, and it's a disaster in my view, after the next presidential election is very real, and that's why we need to be activated right now to prevent the first step, which is the Republicans taking over Congress in November.
I don't disagree with that, and I want to point out one thing that you said that I think is super important, Ira. When we talk about tech, so that's just a very small part of what you said, the problem with tech is it's both commerce and critical infrastructure, and we deal with those in a really different way. So in things in Congress, you know, I mean, you should try to make gobs of money. You should try to make more money than you're making now. You should do that in any way that's legally possible. You know, that's the way the private sector works. When you're talking about critical infrastructure, you know, our water, our power, our electricity, and now our internet, you know, you don't want it to be exploitative. You don't want it to be unfair. You don't want it to be insecure. Those are things you want it to be safe. And those are things that require public sector oversight, you know, rules, legislation, policies, standards. You know, you want to make sure that, you know, the things that you use don't kill you. You know, that's what OSHA is for. That's what the FDA is for. And, you know, we don't have the right kinds of equivalents of those things when it comes to the internet and technologies we use as critical infrastructure. So, yeah, if the next administration or this administration thinks of technology as purely commerce, you know, they're going to let private sector businesses do whatever they need to do to make a profit. But if they start thinking about pieces of it, not all of it, but pieces of it as critical infrastructure, they've got to regulate it.
A couple of letters.
Can you imagine what the fate of an OSHA would be under a Trump administration with a Republican Congress? I mean, that's a great example of a agency that is designed to protect people and health and safety and all the rest, but is also viewed in business circles as an onerous group. And anytime you hear OSHA has been to your place, you get angry and you get worried. And that's the sort of thing that Trump would not want to happen. He would virtually strip OSHA of its ability to do its job, in my opinion. And that's just one agency.
Right.
Either that or put somebody up in charge of OSHA who will, you know, only do what he wants. We've seen that play out of the playbook before.
Yeah. I mean,
OSHA is really a feared. And even, you know, if OSHA comes to your place and someone has complained to you, complained to them about something going on, even if you are cleared of that OSHA investigation, you wind up paying. They find something else while they're there.
Sure.
I can tell you that from experience.
Sure. And do you remember when the Justice Department was a feared institution?
I don't, but I believe it. You're talking about when J. Edgar Hoover was around?
Well, no, either that or when the Justice Department followed the lead and the law wherever it went.
Yeah.
Which, when Trump was the president, it certainly didn't.
We've got about, well, actually, we're going to take a break. So we'll pause, we'll take a break, and then when we come back, I've got a couple letters, we'll move on to other stuff. And we'll finish out our time together. Alan Chartok, Ira Fussfeld, Judy Patrick, and Fran Berman all with us this morning. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will continue our conversation after news from the BBC.
Someone has to pay the price.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Welcome your letters. Last call for those. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Let's see. I would like to move on to some other topics, and then we'll get to some letters as we finish out our morning discussion. I know we've asked the question several times on this program. Various panel members, including myself, have asked the question of whatever happened to the Matt Gaetz case. Well, we learned something yesterday. The ex-girlfriend of the Florida representative Matt Gaetz appeared Wednesday before a federal grand jury investigating the congressman for possible sex trafficking of a minor, according to a person familiar with the matter. A signal that the probe remains active more than a year after it began. CNN and NBC both spotted the woman and her attorney entering the federal courthouse in Orlando. A person familiar with the matter who spoke on the condition of anonymity to the Washington Post because they were not authorized to discuss the matter confirmed she was there as part of the Gaetz investigation. A Justice Department spokesman declined to comment. A lawyer for the woman confirmed to the Post that he and a client were at the federal courthouse in Orlando, but did not comment further. Isabel Kirshner, as a lawyer for Gaetz, said, "We have seen no credible basis for a charge against the congressman. We remain steadfast in our commitment to challenge any allegations with the facts and law." You will probably remember that Matt Gaetz has been under investigation for possible sex trafficking since late 2020 during the final months of President Trump's administration, and he has repeatedly denied wrongdoing. Investigators are exploring whether he paid for sex in violation of federal sex trafficking laws and had been particularly interested in his dealings with a 17-year-old girl. Gaetz has denied ever paying for sex or having been sexually involved with a 17-year-old as an adult. The appearance of his ex-girlfriend before a federal grand jury is a potentially ominous sign for the congressman, as she would provide insight into his personal life and dealings with women. It is unclear, though, what she has told the grand jury, whose proceedings are held out of public view. The ex-girlfriend was among several women on a trip Gaetz allegedly took to the Bahamas in 2018 that has been of interest to criminal investigators. The 17-year-old at issue in the investigation was also on that trip. Though she was an adult at that time, people familiar with the matter have said. Oh, what do we make of this tangled web? Judy, do you want us to start?
Well, you know, first of all, kudos to the CNN and for NBC for staking out the courthouse, because that's the only way you find out these things. They usually don't get leaked. And all you can do is watch who comes and goes. It's kind of boring work, but eventually you'll find out something. But, it has taken a while for this to work its way through the system. A key part of the case, it seems to be, is his friend, this Mr. Greenberg, who has pleaded guilty in the case. He's due to be scheduled next month or the month after for his part in sex trafficking. But but the problem with prosecutors, as you know, in every case, it comes up all the time, is, you know, the people who are testifying against you, how credible they are. And so let's see what the former girlfriend had to say, or we may never see what the former girlfriend had to say. And he gets a little bit of credit for just, you know, he just oblivious to it or denying it and proceeding as all is normal. He's still raising money as a Republican. He's still right there with the former president. You know, the question is where, how much the former president is going to be supporting him if this actually does proceed to criminal charges.
Ira.
Well, there's nothing more that I'd like to see than Gates being let out of the courthouse in handcuffs. But the fact of the matter is, the man is entitled to due process, and they're running an investigation. And we've just seen, although the cases are different in any number of ways, we've just seen with the Cuomo situation in New York how someone could be deemed by prosecutors to be credible, and nonetheless the case doesn't go to trial and nobody is arrested. So I don't know how this is going to turn out, and you want this to be a methodical and accurate investigation, but it does strike me as taking an awfully long time for this thing to move along. And one would think that if this was a slam dunk, he would have already been indicted by now. So, but the man is, in my view, despicable, I have nothing but bad thoughts about him.
Well, I agree with you on all those counts. You know, at the end of the year last year, as all of this news was funneling in, I mean, it seemed like he was just a dead man walking, and then everything just stopped. There is an investigation going on. You're absolutely right that he is, you know, certainly entitled to a fair investigation. But it does seem that there was some lallygagging. Alan, your thoughts on all this?
I agree with what's been said and have nothing to add.
All right. Fran?
Yuck. I don't know. You know, all of this, you know, I don't know. It's also darn discouraging, you know, shades of Jeffrey Epstein, you know, this combination of the use of power, the use of exploitation, the use of, you know, thinking you're above the law, which is what it seems to me, who is not on the grand jury, I'd like to point out. I don't know. You know, this guy just looks like scum to me. Why do we have these people in public service? I don't know.
Well, and Judy, I mean, you brought this up of not giving him credit exactly, but he has largely ignored it. He's barnstorming the country with Marjorie Taylor Greene. They're making gobs of money in all of these appearances. And in all parts of the country, so it really is something. The fact that there are these charges do not seem to be putting him in the shadows at all.
No, the only thing that's keeping him alive on social media is his resemblance to Billy Munster.
Well, that's something.
Wow. Poor Eddie Munster. There is that.
So maybe he's an illegitimate part of the Munster family. Is that what you're suggesting, Judy?
You know, well, but it, you know, it, I guess I should be serious and say that as a Republican, I don't see him being disavowed. And rightly so, I guess. He hasn't been charged. The allegations seem very serious, and he has a known reputation for treating women badly. But has it risen to the criminal level? You know, I think it's taken a long time. I'm not that worried about the fact that things have taken a long time. Sometimes justice does move slowly. It could have been it's taken a long time to either convince the former girlfriend to testify, to persuade her to testify. Sometimes these things take an awful long time to put together. Just think of the investigations into the Trump finances in New York State. That's taken forever.
Good point.
I'm not happy with that either.
Yeah. We want things to move more quickly.
Are we going
quickly.
Back to the Munster theory? I just want to know.
No. By the way, Butch Patrick has nothing to do with this story. I just want to make sure his name is cleared in this, that we're not in any way suggesting that the actor.
I know it's a different family, but I'm trying to figure out who looks like Uncle Fester, but that's nobody has immediately come to mind.
The Coogan rule. All right, let's go to this. Judy mentioned this, and we'll end on this subject about Omicron and what we should make of it, and that is that the Omicron wave appears to be slowing in New York City and other major metropolitan areas. The explosion of Omicron cases along the I-95 corridor from the Mid-Atlantic to New England is showing signs of slowing down, according to health officials and epidemiologists, offering reason for cautious optimism that the turning point could be near and that the coronavirus variant's U.S. trajectory is similar to that of other countries. New York Governor Kathy Hochul said Tuesday the rates of test returning positive and case increases seem to be slowing, particularly in New York City, which emerged as an early epicenter of the highly contagious variant. They're still high, Hochul said, but we are not at the end. But I want to say that this is, to me, a glimmer of hope, in a time when we desperately need that. Your thoughts on that attitude, Alan?
Yeah.
By the governor.
Well, yeah, you know, she certainly is right to hang on to this for dear life because it could make all the difference to her politically. And she's a competent manager, and I think she knows what she's doing. However, my question is, and I'm sure the panel joins me in this, based on what we've seen so far, is what's next? In other words, we do know that, you know, this thing has a way of hanging on or mutating or changing. And I don't think anybody should be taking a deep bow right now based on the fact that it might go away. It might. And we have seen that in other countries where it's, you know, it comes on strong and then it dissipates. But nobody should be thinking this is the end, because I don't think so. Not for a minute.
Fran?
Yeah, I agree with Alan. I think that the trends are good, although, you know, I want to say again, and you know, there's never enough times to repeat this, it's really hard to model this, and you have to figure out what you're trying to model. But all of the kinds of models we're using does indicate that Omicron, at least, you know, could peak. So the trends are good, and, you know, I personally am, you know, trying to minimize my number of in-person, indoor interactions in January with hopes that, you know, February just starts seeing more, you know, in quotes, normal, at least normal for the pandemic or normal for Delta. I agree with Alan. I think you can't discount the fact that there might be some new mutation, you know, soon, and it might have a really different character. It's really interesting that no one ever talks about having the Spanish flu anymore, you know. You know, all of the things that have kind of settled out eventually are things that have become in the sort of no big deal. You know, we could get the flu, we could get a cold, but we don't, you know, not carry on our lives with that fear like we do a bit with the pandemic. And so if Omicron hastens the time that the coronavirus is part of our firmament and we find some new normal where it doesn't have such a big impact on healthcare and the economy and all kinds of other things, that would be great. You know, are we there yet? You know, probably not. But these trends are good with Omicron, and they at least let us get to the place we were starting to get used to with Delta.
With a minute or two left, go ahead, Alan, and then.
I was just going to say to that remark, and that is, you're right. It can change. It will change. But think about it. You know, things like the flu, which we've lived through for so many years, we know what the limitations on the flu are. At least so far, we know that. We don't know that with this present disease.
Judy Patrick?
Well, I just want to jump in with something.
Go ahead,
I said before on the roundtable, which is yay science. You know, the fact that we know any of this, the fact that we have data, the fact that we have vaccines, the fact that we have boosters, the fact that we have models that are sort of working. Yay science.
Judy?
And a little bit of good news, the scientists are already working on of changing the vaccine so it will attack more different variants of, and specifically they're working on an Omicron one, but they would like to get an all-purpose one out there fairly soon.
Ira, I have bad news. We have a live guest, and I don't have time to go to you for your response on this, but I do have this as a gift, and I think it's when I get on the air and we do this show that I think to myself, are we making a difference in the lives of the people that we're broadcasting to? Is the panel making a difference to people? And we have 4 letters from listeners over the last several minutes answering your question, Ira, of saying Louis Gohmert is Uncle Fester.
I like it.
So I hope that makes you feel better.
That makes my day. Well, I was gonna interject a Mad Magazine joke, but I'll save it for another time.
Oh, now I wish we had the time. All right. My thanks to everybody. Alan, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Ira Fussfeld, Judy Patrick, Fran Berman, thank you. A great pleasure. We will be back right after this.